many, many years ago, back in the late 60s and beyond. It seems like we hear about it a little less now. And I think back at some of the teachings, or I'm not absolutely sure it was a teaching per se, but at least some of the people back when I first came into the Worldwide Church of God in the late 60s, 1968, the Sabbath had come around, and some of the people, I know they were dedicated people, and they wanted to do everything exactly right, and sometimes I think maybe they went a little bit overboard with this statement, because I've known of some people on the Sabbath day, if they had an unconverted wife or an unconverted husband, that they would basically lock themselves in their room on the Sabbath day and not have anything to do with their own mate and children. And I believe that that was a little bit overboard, you know, that I don't think that's exactly what God intended for us to do. Again, I'm sure those people were sincere, and they, in their own mind, they wanted to get it exactly right, and based on what they had read and heard, that they thought that this is the way to do it. But over a period of months and years, you begin to see the fruits of that, and some of the families of those people were really turned off, and you could understand if you were unconverted and really didn't understand God's plan in the first place, and all of a sudden, your mate was called, began to attend services, and all of a sudden, you know, they're just a different person, and I can't deal with you, my husband or my wife, on the Sabbath day. I have to go to church, and I have to go home, and I have to lock myself in the room with the Bible and read the Bible all day long. I've watched things change from that to a lot of correction was made. You know, we begin to get more balance. The pendulum began to swing back in the other direction, which I do believe that was a very good thing. You know, we were adjusting on what we had learned from experience, and we're coming back to normal. But I think there's an old saying, you know, that sometimes the pendulum never stops. And I believe that we have somewhat, at least where I've been, and it may not be that way throughout all the Sabbath-keeping churches, but where I've been, I think that we've kind of swung beyond the middle, beyond balance, and got to the other extreme a little bit. And some of the things we do on the Sabbath, perhaps we should not be doing. There's no question that we are to come out of her, talking about the false religions. There is no question about that. That's biblical. But what I'm trying to deal with is the degree and exactly what we're to do in order to come out of the false systems in this world. And I want to start by reading in Revelation 18. I'll read several verses there, starting in verse 1. Revelation 18 and verse 1. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Now, most of us have been around a long time in a Sabbath-keeping church somewhere, and I would imagine that most of us remember the duality that Mr. Armstrong used to talk about of scriptures, and if there's ever a place where that would apply, I believe it is in this verse, this Revelation 18, verse 2. It's talking about Babylon the Great is fallen. So it's looking forward to that time when this false Babylonian system will finally fall. It's looking to the future. But also, it's looking back to the past because the original Babylon, you know, the city of Babel or Babylon, it says, is become the habitation of devils. And we know that that is a fact. You can go over there in Iraq to the city of Babel, and you can see that it's in, you know, it's a ruin. It's not a real city anymore. It's a place visitors go and to learn a little history. But it did, in the past, you know, this system that Nimrod started. Nimrod is the one that built Babel in the first place. And he started the system. Now, but that city, that place, is the habitation of devils and hateful birds, unclean and hateful birds, it says there at the end of the verse. But the future application is the system, even though the city is in disarray and the habitation of bad things, devils, the system lives on. And the system we see throughout the United States and Europe and a good part of the world. And it's the system that Nimrod started. And that will fall in the future when Jesus Christ returns. And going on in verse 3, it tells us a little bit about it. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. You know, all nations have learned this system that Nimrod started. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. You know, that is symbolic, not literal physical fornication. It's spiritual fornication. The governments of the earth have looked to the main organization that promotes this system, which is, frankly, the Catholic Church. And the governments around the world look to that Catholic Church as their leader, in a sense. And the Catholic Church has, over the years, become so powerful that they control much of the business throughout the whole world. You know, if you remember the sex scandal up in, I believe it was Boston or Baltimore, Boston, I believe, that they paid out billions of dollars in that one church area because of some wrong activity by the priest. So they're exceedingly rich. And they do control a lot of the commerce throughout the world, especially in the United States. I think most people don't realize how much they control and affect the economy. But it says, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. So God tells us very plainly about the relationship between the economy, you know, the merchants, and this false system. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. There is that phrase that I used as a title for the sermon. Come out of her, my people. And it is talking about coming out of this system. It is not talking about locking yourself away from your unconverted mate on the Sabbath day. It's talking about coming out of a system that primarily keeps Sunday as the day of worship and the various holidays that have been substituted for the holy days or for their holy days. I would like to go to 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17. I'll just read one verse there if you don't want to turn there, but it reinforces this idea that we're to come out. Verse 17 of 2 Corinthians 6. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing. What is the unclean thing? It can be physical, you know, the food that we eat, but primarily the spiritual, the wrong spiritual teaching is the implication. We're to leave that behind us. It says, and I will receive you. And if we do that, and God receives us, that's when we have or receive God's Spirit. And that backs up what Thomas Jefferson said in this quote here about Christianity being the only religion that actually changes the heart. You know, from that time when we're called and receive God's Spirit, we're supposed to change. And we're supposed to change dramatically. Get rid of every wrong idea, every wrong thought, and every wrong action. I don't think any of us have done that perfectly yet, but certainly we're working on it. The very fact that we're here, you know, indicates we're working on it. We're trying. So, exactly what does he mean then to come out of her, and how do we do it? How do we come out of the system? I remember back in the worldwide, and it must have been, let's see, about 1980, 81, very early 80s, I would say, when the order came out from Pasadena for the ministers to join the civic clubs in their community in order to make a good impression on the community and, you know, display your personality and your ability to influence the world and to grow the church, it didn't work. You know, it coincides almost exactly with the time that the church started deteriorating and getting smaller and having more problems. Right after the ministers received that order, you know, go join the Lions Club, the Elks, the whatever, you know, the civic organizations so that you can make a big impression and use your personality to bring people into the church. Well, that is not the way it works. And I think what we saw happen to the worldwide Church of God later on pretty well proves that that is just not the way it works. We are to come out of this system. And we are to be a light, an example to the world. But, you know, basically, if you want to sum that up in the shortest way possible, I would say the way we do that is keep the Ten Commandments. If we keep the Ten Commandments, our neighbors are going to notice it. Our neighbors are going to begin to trust us more than they did before. They know that they can, you know, leave their property and trust us to look after it while they're on vacation and things like that. And they will know that unlike the Sunday worshipers, we go to church on the Sabbath day and we're very dedicated about doing that. We're willing to drive, as we were talking just before services, about when I came into the church up in Michigan, some of the old-timers of that age. I'm the old-timer now, but the old-timers back then talked about driving all the way from Detroit to Chicago to go to Sabbath services. That meant getting up some like 3 o'clock in the morning for some of them and drive 4 or 5 hours and attend Sabbath services and usually stay around for a potluck and fellowship and drive back home and get home in the middle of the night. A long, long trip. But they were dedicated, you know, they were trying to do the right thing. People noticed that. You know, many of us here will drive for an hour or so to get the services. So, from time to time, we may hear the comment that, why do you go that far? You know, there's a church just down the road here from you. Why not just go there? You know, you save a lot of time and get to know your neighbors better. Well, we keep a different day. But it's to come out of the system. Out of the system. And people will notice. It's not to go out there and show them, you know, with the idea that we're going to show them how great we are. That's not it. They will notice. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. We'll start reading in verse 9. Of course, this is Paul writing here. I wrote unto you in an epistle not to company with fornicators, yet not altogether with the fornicators of the world. And, you know, that's a very, very interesting phrase to me. Because in coming out of the world, it doesn't mean that we should all move to an island and be that separate. And that thought crossed my mind. I remember thinking that when I was first called, you know, and I thought everybody in God's church was perfect except me. And I thought, why don't we just buy an island, you know, and be separate? Well, of course, I understand now that that's certainly not what God had in mind. But Paul here says to come out, to don't keep company with fornicators, yet not altogether with fornicators of this world. It's an admission that you can't cut yourself off from every sinner in the world. You can't do it. I mean, you have to deal with them. And when you go to the market, you're going to deal with people like that. If you have a job, you're going to deal with people like that, most likely. And you can't totally, 100% cut yourself off from the world. That's important. That is important because it adds balance to this statement of come out of her. Going on, it says, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or with idolaters, for then must you needs go out of the world. We would literally have to go out of the world. I don't know where, out in outer space, I guess, or drop dead. If we live in this world, we're going to have some contact and some communication with people who sin, and Paul acknowledges that. He says, going on in verse 11, but now I have written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator. And here he makes a distinct difference in how we react to brothers and sisters in the church as compared to how we react to the average person we meet out there in the world who's not been called. And the distinction is that we're more strict with our own brothers and sisters in the church than we are with the people in the world. And there's a good reason for that. And we have an example. If we refuse to fellowship with people who we know, that is brothers and sisters, who we know are fornicators or regularly committing some other sin and will not repent of it, then we are to withdraw from them and not fellowship with them. We can't do that with people in the world. I mean, you can't go down to Walmart and find out that the cashier is not converted and say, I'm not going to go to Walmart anymore. You have the same problem with any other store you go to. So there's a distinct difference. So any brother, be a fornicator or covetous or an adulterer or a railer or a drunkard or an extortioner, with such a one not to eat. We shouldn't even sit down with a brother who is blatantly sinning and has been told and knows better. For what have I to do to judge them also that are without? You know, we can't do anything about them. But maybe we can help to steer a brother or a sister in the right direction. Maybe we can have some influence on them, but not people in the world. It says, do not you judge them that are within? Paul's saying, don't you already judge your brothers and sisters? But them that are without, God judges. Therefore, put away from among yourselves that wicked person. And we know what Paul is talking about here, because there was a man in the congregation that was having an affair, if you will, with his mother-in-law. So God says, don't fellowship with him. In James 1, verse 27, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless, the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. You know, come out of the world, the systems. Don't do the things that they do. And it's important that we have to have some relationship with them. But to get balance, we cannot spend the majority of our time with unconverted people. If we do that, we will begin to take on some of their habits. It's almost inevitable. It rubs off on you. You learn to be what you see around you. You know, you can look at what's going on in the Muslim world today, you know, when you see little six-year-old girls even talking about people like, oh, they're just pigs, you know, they're apes, they deserve to die, you know, I'd like to cut their head off, and that kind of thing. They learn from what is around them. And we do the same. We learn from what is around them. If we spend too much time with unconverted people, we will begin to take on their habits. We will begin to think what they do is okay. In John chapter 8, I'm going to be skipping around quite a bit. Maybe read one or two verses in a place here, but John chapter 8 and verse 12. Then spoke Jesus again to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. The light of life. That's how we become an example to the world without becoming a part of the world. You know, I remember somewhere in the past where I read an article about some minister that he was going to go down in the ghetto, go down in the sin-ridden areas of the city and convert the people down there. Well, I can imagine that if he spends a lot of time there, he's going to end up being like them instead of the other way around. Because he'll be outnumbered in the first place, and he'll begin to take on their habits, he'll listen to their stories, begin to sympathize with them, and more become more and more like them. I know of a case in the church, a fellow minister that I have shared a podium with a time or two, but he decided he was going to do good in order to that person. So he invited a person who had just got out of prison to come and live with him because the person was homeless. And within, I think it was in just a few months, it might have been a year or so, but I believe in a very few months, he come home and his guests and his wife were gone. And they didn't come back. So, you know, there is a limit on what you can do with people who have those habits. Matthew 5. And I read verse 14. Because we just read that Jesus said he is the light of the world, but Matthew 5, verse 14, it says, you are the light of the world. And if we take on Jesus Christ's nature, we are the light of the world. People will notice. If a light, you know, someone brings a light into a dark room, it's noticed. And if we do what we're supposed to do, we don't have to go out there and preach to unconverted people. We don't have to get down in the gutter and fellowship with them. The light will shine. It goes on to say, you're a city that is set on the hill, cannot be hid. If we are a light, it can't be hid. It will be noticed. Dropping down to verse 13 in Matthew 5. It also says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is therefore good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot of men. Kind of like the light, you know. If the filament in the light burns out, it doesn't shine anymore. What good is it? It's to be thrown away. You could compare that to God's Spirit within us. If we lose God's Spirit, we cease to be a light. We cease to be a light to the people around us. If you turn to John 13. John 13 and verse 15. Simple verse, for I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. We should follow the example of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ did relate to unconverted people. And often, you know, when he met them out in public and they approached him, he related to them, even healed some of them. But he did not spend most of his time with unconverted people. He spent most of his time, I guess I'd have to backtrack a little bit. He spent most of his time with those who were his disciples, and most of whom became his apostles. And in the true sense, they weren't converted either, but they chose to follow him at that time, and they received his Spirit later. But the point is, we should follow the example of Jesus Christ. In 1 Titus 4 and verse 1. 1 Titus 4 and verse 1. Now I don't know. Now I'll have to look that up in my Bible. My note says 1 and 2, and I don't know if that's 1 or 2 or 12. In fact, I think it's 1 Timothy anyway. I put down the wrong verse. The verse that I wanted to read, it says, "Let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity." And I'm not sure what that is now. I copied the wrong number. Sorry. In James 5 in verse 10. "Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience." We heard something about patience in the sermonette. It's part of being a good Christian. We are going to have tribulation, suffering, problems, sickness, disease, financial problems, some of us. We're going to have problems, period. And we're to take them with patience, and as an example, think about what Jesus Christ himself went through when he had to face death, and he knew what was coming ahead of time. He had to face it, and he was patient, and he was willing to accept it. He wasn't happy about the idea overall, but as he realized that that was the only way that we could have a chance to have eternal life, he was willing to do it. He was willing to endure the suffering. And that's what we're supposed to do. In John 17 and verse 15, John 17 and verse 15. Jesus Christ's own prayer. He says, "I pray not that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil." Again, you know, it reinforces that idea that we're to come out of that evil system, but we still have to deal with the world that we live in. And verse 16, "They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world." The Sabbaths are primarily for God. And I've already mentioned the fact of what some people did on the Sabbath, you know, withdraw from their family and that sort of thing. But in Exodus 20, is our authority for the Sabbath, Exodus 20, verse 8. It says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord, your God. In it you shall not do any work, you nor your son nor your daughter, your manservant nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor any stranger that is within your gates. Now, that's another area where we've taken God's word and sometimes gone overboard with it. And I've told this on myself. When I was a new Christian and I used to drive out to Ann Arbor on the Sabbath day to go to church, and I started, I'd read these verses. You can't do any work on the Sabbath day. And I started thinking, what if I have a flat? And I'm almost there, there's nobody around. I can't fix it. I guess I'll just have to sit there till sundown. Well, that's kind of silly, but it actually went through my mind because I was converted, or I was being converted, and I wanted to do the right thing. And I had read this verse, you shall not do any work. It says right there in Exodus 20 on the Sabbath day. Well, I was pretty unbalanced at the time. To bring some balance to that verse, let's go to Matthew 12. Matthew 12, and I'll start reading in verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungry, began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, behold, your disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. I guess they were allowed to eat the corn if somebody had already pulled it and chucked it and cut it off the cob or what have you. But the Pharisees said, that's unlawful. But he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and they that were with him? He entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priest. So he's giving the example of David. And David was not held responsible for that. They were hungry. God made allowances for the fact that they were hungry, and that was the only bread available to them. David was on the run, from Saul. And the men that was with him, they were hungry. God is a merciful God. He takes those things into consideration. So, you can go astray by picking one verse and just dwelling on it and taking it literally. And I've said many times over the years, the Bible is not a technical book. Technically, it's not 100% true. You can't look at it that way. God inspired every word that is here, but it was written by the writers of the Bible, and they use their own words and their own method of expression. And sometimes you'll read something like we just read there in Exodus 20, you shall not do any work on the Sabbath day. So, I had my problem with that. And the Pharisees got to the point that, you cannot slap a fly on the Sabbath day because that's work. You just have to let it sit there and eat you, I guess. Going on in verse 5. Have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? What are Mr. Sancho and I doing today? Sabbath day, We're working. Somebody has to work on the Sabbath day. If you have a Sabbath service, somebody has to work. So God makes exceptions. God is not unreasonable. Verse 6, but I say to you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. You know, if you look at that commandment in Exodus 20, you shall do no work on the Sabbath day. You know, you could condemn a lot of people who should not be condemned, who God does not condemn. So there are exceptions. I remember a deacon in our church worked for the powder company, and I think it was, well, I don't know which storm it was, but one of the major storms that came into South Florida, the area was devastated, and they were asking for electricians, you know, people who worked for the power, different power companies around the country, to go to Florida. And he went to Florida and worked right on throughout the weekend, almost day and night, because there were people suffering. There were old people, sick people who had no power. And it was his judgment that was doing good on the Sabbath, and God would make an exception. You know, I don't condemn him for his judgment. I would even say that he was probably correct. We know that there are people in the hospitals. Somebody has to take care of them. We know that there are people in God's church where one mate is very, very sick and the other is extremely burdened to the point that they have to do almost everything. And they have to do it on the Sabbath day. Maybe they can't even leave them long enough to attend Sabbath services, but they have to take care of them. They do some work. God is a merciful God. God makes exceptions for people who do good on the Sabbath. Verse 8, it says, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And when he was departed from there, he went into the synagogue, and behold, there was a man which had his hand withered, and they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him? They were waiting to accuse him. If you heal this man, we know you have broken the Sabbath. You have violated the fourth commandment. And he said to them, what man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? An exception for an animal. Maybe it was for the owner too, because sheep, you know, if you have one sheep, it's probably pretty valuable to you. But make an exception for an animal. It says, how much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath. So, in summary, our relationship to the world in general, we have to deal with them. From time to time, we can't separate ourselves from them entirely. On the other hand, we don't want to spend most of our time with those people because it will rub off on us. We'll begin to do what they do and think it's okay. We can't be a light to the world if we're completely cut off from the world. We can't be an example to the world if we're completely cut off to the world. So we have to live in the world. You know, we're the salt of the earth, which I think most people interpret that to mean that we're sprinkled throughout the earth. You know, that's what we do with salt. We sprinkle it. And we are scattered throughout the world. And we're supposed to be an example, supposed to be a light. Relationship to unconverted family. The Sabbath is primarily for God. God absolutely needs to come first on the Sabbath day, wherever it's possible. And I don't want to refute what I just said about there are exceptions and there's people who have to take care of their mates or whatever and they cannot attend Sabbath services. But when you're able, God has to come first, and especially on the Sabbath day. I've dealt with problems in the church over the years. I've had several of them. I remember one lady in the church who had a habit of, they had a family reunion, she insisted on going and missing church. When I moved back to Kentucky, my family was scattered here and there from Michigan to Maryland, what have you, but Indiana, some of them. I started having a reunion on a weekend. Actually, it was always on Sunday as far as I was concerned. But some of the family would come in early, like on Friday, and some of my sisters started inviting them over on the Sabbath. But I made it a point, even though my family was coming in that I hadn't seen sometimes for years, especially when they first started it, I hadn't seen them for years. But I went to Sabbath services on the Sabbath. I've always made it a policy that church comes first. Now, after I went to Sabbath services, and one of my sisters was gathering the family up at their house, if I got back from Sabbath services in time, sure, I have gone and visited with them some, but I would never, ever do that and leave off the Sabbath, because God has to come first. Actually, that is an opinion. That's not a doctrine. I don't make doctrine. That's an opinion. It's my opinion. I was just telling you the way that I look at it. Someone may have a different idea. But I do know that that first and great commandment says that we are to put God first, and that's my interpretation of the way to put God first on the Sabbath day. So I hope that that is some help. It brings some balance. I've seen the pendulum way to the left, and I've seen it swing way to the right, or vice versa, you know. But we need to come to a balance in dealing with people in the church and out of the church.